Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm happy to be here with you.
Yeah, we're definitely looking forward to your visit at the Wellington School. So I guess let's start by saying, because you're going to be talking about stress and anxiety in young people, and I feel like as a society, we've become a little bit better at talking about that more openly, but I'm wondering if we still have a lot of work to do in regards to, you know, school-aged kids. Is that your assessment?
Well, I think we're talking about it a lot. I'm not sure we're talking about it in the most helpful way. Part of why I wrote my most recent book, Under Pressure, which is about stress and anxiety in girls, but most of what I say also applies to boys, is that there's a lot of discussion of stress and anxiety, but we tend to frame them as being harmful all the time and never having a positive side. And in fact, psychologists, we've long believed that stress is a normal and expectable aspect of everyday life, and it's part of growing, and it's part of becoming more durable in the face of life's challenges, and that anxiety is a normal and healthy protective function that all humans come equipped with that lets us know when it's time to pay attention or be on our toes. Both stress and anxiety can reach unhealthy levels, and when they do, psychologists know what to do to help. But for most people, most days, stress and anxiety are just a normal and expectable part of life. And I think that message may not be coming across to kids as much as it should be.
So then, you know, before we get into some of the ways to recognize when it's being utilized in an unhealthy way, or, you know, when it's at an unhealthy level, I think you did mention that it's on the rise, anxiety in young people. Can you go into a little bit more about that regarding the stats or what you've noticed in your practice?
Sure. So in terms of the stats, we are seeing more young people reporting feelings associated with anxiety, telling us they feel stressed, they feel overwhelmed, they feel nervous, they feel fearful, and that those numbers have been going up. We're especially able to detect this at the college level, actually, where college counseling programs do a really good job of surveying college-age students. And what we're seeing is that over time, the number of students who say they feel overwhelmed and don't know how to manage anxiety and feel really kind of at their limit on a regular basis, that number has climbed very steadily. And one thing that we have seen is that this is more true for girls than boys. And this is not new. Always, historically, we've seen that girls are twice as likely to be diagnosed with anxiety disorders as boys. And so this is a little bit disproportionately heavy on girls. And the reason for that, there's a few reasons. The simplest reason is just that our culture socializes girls a bit, that if they are feeling distress, they're more likely to collapse in on themselves than boys are, whereas boys are more likely when they're distressed to act out and get themselves in trouble. So it's not that girls are experiencing so much more distress than boys per se, it's just that they are more likely than boys to experience their distress as anxiety. But a lot of boys report feeling highly anxious, do suffer from anxiety disorders, but the numbers are going up across the board, and, you know, then again, the weight falls disproportionately on girls.
So it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're trying to equip parents and school staff with the tools to maybe prevent anxiety from getting out of control by the time they hit college, or giving them the tools to manage it in a healthy way rather than responding to what's already going on?
That's right. There's a couple of ways to slice it. So first of all, we do help kids out when we normalize stress and anxiety. When they're feeling stressed, and we say, yeah, well, school is supposed to be stressful. That's part of growing at school. And, you know, you're not going to learn if you don't experience some degree of feeling pushed and at your edge, which is definitely a stressful experience. And same with anxiety. When kids say, I feel really anxious about this test, if we say, well, have you studied? And they say, no. Then we say, okay, then you're having the right reaction. Like, anxiety is a good thing here. You should be anxious. So it's important that we help young people understand that stress and anxiety are everyday experiences, because if we react as though something's wrong, what happens is that young people then become stressed about being stressed and anxious about being anxious. So that's the first step, is to not make it worse when it doesn't have to be. And then the second step is to help young people manage the stresses and anxieties that come their way and to manage those effectively. And in my book, Under Pressure, the way I divide the book is that chapter one is called Coming to Terms with Stress and Anxiety. So just, you know, gaining a real understanding. And then chapter two is Type of Girls at Home. So it's the transactions that occur between parents and children. And then chapter three is Girls Among Girls. Chapter four is Girls Among Boys. Chapter five is Girls at School. And then chapter six is Girls in the Culture. So I try to really go layer by layer through young women's lives to prepare parents to help their daughters deal very effectively with the stresses that come their way in any variety of domains.
Awesome. And I'm wondering if it's a learning curve for parents too, because if I think back to my own childhood and, you know, how my parents handled my stress and anxiety, I don't know that they realized that it was as harmful to, not harmful, it was as challenging to me. Like, my stress was as challenging to me as their stress was challenging to them, even though we had different types of stress. So do you notice that some parents are, it's almost like thinking in a different way for them? Like, I may be struggling to pay bills, but, you know, my children are struggling with other things in school and in social situations.
Well, it's interesting. I think what you're describing is that sometimes adults can go in the wrong direction in a couple different ways. So sometimes, like I was describing, they may overreact to a child's stress. You know, the child's like, I'm really stressed about school. And the parent's like, oh my gosh, you've got to drop a class. We've got to call the school. You know, we've got to take, you know, severe measures to manage your stress, as opposed to saying, yeah, well, school's hard. And what are you doing to take care of yourself? And, you know, what are you learning? How are you growing? The flip of it is that sometimes parents can be very dismissive of kids' stress. You know, say, oh man, you've got kid-sized problems. Like, wait till you have a mortgage. That's real stress. And not really engage in a useful way with their kids around stress. And so my aim is to help parents kind of find a good middle path where they are validating and supportive and engage seriously with the fact that stress is uncomfortable and everyone needs strategies for managing it, and yet at the same time not react as though stress is out of control and dangerous, because that's very rarely true.
Yeah. You know, I also want to talk to you about social media, because I think that's one of the major things that is different. And today, you know, in this age, when I was growing up, I didn't have to worry about that. But what role have you noticed social media playing in stress and anxiety among adolescents and teens?
Well, it's interesting because we're really trying to study this, and it's very hard to study in terms of getting a clear causal explanation in terms of saying the social media does cause more stress for kids, because it might also be the case that kids who are feeling really stressed spend a lot of time on social media to try to cope with their stress. So we don't really know one way or the other yet what causes what. But here's what we do know when we are doing thoughtful longitudinal studies, watching kids over time. What we know is that sleep deprivation causes stress, that sleep is the glue that holds human beings together. And if people don't get enough sleep, they're going to be more stressed. They're going to be more anxious. They'll just be kind of more fragile and brittle all around. And what we know is that social media use can have a very high connection to sleep deprivation, especially if teenagers have their phones or their technology in their rooms at night, especially when they're supposed to be sleeping in those times. Mm-hmm. So the thing we can say with certainty is that if your child is sleeping less because of their relationship with social media, that will contribute to higher rates of stress and anxiety. Like, this we know, and we're really clear on it. As for the rest, you know, we don't have a clear causal sense yet, but we do know that, you know, being connected to one's peers is fun, but being connected to one's peers is also stressful. Mm-hmm. And so even when kids are having a good time on social media and enjoying themselves, we do have to be mindful that they still probably need a break and some downtime where they are just quiet and centered and not maintaining all of the activity of having a lot of social connection around them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read that you practiced in a private school as a psychologist or a counselor.
So I am a psychologist and I have a private practice, but I also consult 2 days a week to a girls' school in Shaker Heights, Ohio, where I live. So I've consulted at local school for 16 years, which means that I'm there during the school day and interacting with the girls and their faculty and also their parents. And it's given me a really terrific look at kind of everyday stress and anxiety in young women, and how stress and anxiety play out for a wide range of kids. And then that plus the work I do in my private practice where I take care of people who are, you know, suffering at a pretty, you know, a level worth, you know, taking care of in a psychotherapy, kind of helps me round out my understanding of what young people are managing.
Yeah, and I was wondering, I don't know if you've studied this or if you have an opinion on this, but I was wondering, are there differences between public school kids and private school kids when it comes to the level of anxiety and stress or the types of stressors that they're facing?
We don't tend to look at it by public versus private. We do look at the data in terms of socioeconomic levels. And, you know, of course, there's a huge wide range of socioeconomic groups who attend public schools, right? So there can be very impoverished families, there can be very wealthy families in public schools. And that's less true in private school environments, where it tends to be, you know, since it's a private pay situation, there can be kids who are of lower income, maybe with supplemental, you know, funding from the school, but it tends to be a higher range in terms of what people's incomes are. So if we slice it that way, you know, acknowledging that it's an imperfect way to slice it,
yeah,
one of the things we see is that stress distributes across the socioeconomic groups in different ways. So if you are impoverished, that's really, really stressful. That's a very chronic and taxing form of stress to be living, you know, at the limit of one's financial ability and to be worrying about money and worrying about security. So there's tremendous stress that comes with that. Interestingly, we are also seeing new data showing that kids in high-pressure, high-achieving environments also suffer as a function of immense pressure and, you know, sort of strain that they feel to do extremely well. And there's a researcher named Sunia Luther who has done really gorgeous work with her time looking at kids in high-achieving, wealthy families. And her work has actually recently caused kids in high-achieving families or high-achieving settings and high-pressure settings to be added to a list of kids who are under particularly difficult circumstances. So we do have some data showing us that both at the lower end economically and at the very high end economically, if there's a lot of academic pressure, that can actually cause undue pressure on kids, or undue stress on kids for various reasons.
Yeah. And, you know, so as a psychologist, there are so many different populations, I imagine, that you work with or have worked with. There are so many different topics. But you seem to be really passionate about working with young people and, in particular, young girls. So I just wanted to ask you personally, why is that such a passion for you?
I always knew I would be a psychologist who worked with kids and teenagers. Somehow that was always what interested me. And then when I first started practicing in Shaker Heights about 20 years ago, I was 29, so it's been a long time ago, and I was sort of on the younger side, and I looked on the younger side, and I started to get calls from parents saying, hey, you know, we hear that you are, you know, a solid clinician, but that you look young, so I think my teenage daughter will talk to you.
Mm.
And so that's sort of a funny thing. There's a sense of, like, maybe teenage daughters don't want to talk to people who look just like their mom, but maybe somebody who seems a little hipper, a little closer to their age. So I think as a function of being, like, relatively young in my practice when I started and being female and the fact that I did see teenagers, I suddenly ended up with this sort of bumper crop of adolescent girls in my practice. And I don't know if that's exactly why, but I just ended up being, like, what I really like and what I know best. And what's been really kind of remarkable for me to discover is that there's always something new for me to learn, that I will never come to the end of my mastery on understanding adolescents and adolescent girls in particular, that they are endlessly fascinating to me, and there's always something new coming up, but there's always something new going on. And the longer I work on them, I just feel like the deeper my understanding gets and the more questions I have.
Interesting. And I would imagine, like, as you're learning new things, though, I'm wondering over time if the same things come up. Like, if you worked with an adolescent 20 years ago and you're working with one today, if they do have similar things that they're struggling with.
They do. I mean, there's some universals, like, you know, really wanting to feel connected socially and really wanting to feel capable academically and worrying, you know, about where they fit in and what's ahead. You know, I think those are the big universals. But what's cool is if you sort of stay with one thing for a long time, at least my experience has been, I keep seeing it in some new or fresh way. You know, that I've always watched girls worry about where they fit in, but I I think it was 20 plus years into doing the work, so I was like, you know, social relationships in middle school, they're kind of like chemistry compounds. Like, you know, girls get themselves into a compound and it's a group of atoms, and there may be a free-floating atom that they all like, but they're not going to add it to the compound because it'll mess up the chemistry they have, you know. And it's helped me understand, as I've watched different dynamics over time, I think my ability to try to make sense of them grows every time I see a new version of the same thing.
Yeah.
I think that's allowed me to try to develop my own nuance in understanding things.
Awesome. What a cool analogy.
Well, it does work, because often there will be a girl who's like, it's so weird. Like, she'll talk to me at school, and she'll call me on the weekend and whatever, but when they're all in a group, I'm not invited. And I think that, you know, thinking about it in terms like of a chemical compound that's rebuffing a free-floating atom has helped me understand. I don't know that it's perfectly accurate, but it's given me a way to help that dynamic feel less personal to the girl who maybe feels left out.
Yeah, awesome. Well, my final question for you is, you know, what's next for you, or what's your vision for the rest of your career? Because you stay pretty busy. As you mentioned, you have the latest book out, Under Pressure, but you're also a New York Times columnist, and you contribute other places, and you practice. So I guess what else is next for you?
You know, I'm still figuring it out. I think sometimes I think like, oh, maybe I've said everything I have to say, and then I go to work and some girl does something I've never seen happen before, or says something, or I feel like I have a new flash of insight. And so I sort of trust that if I just keep showing up at work and I keep talking to young people and I keep taking questions from parents, that's often where I really get my most inspiration, as I think about what is it that parents are really struggling with moment to moment. I sort of feel like what's next will show itself to me.
Awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thanks so much for doing this.
Sure, thank you, and good luck when you come visit us, and, you know, good luck figuring out what's next for you, not that you haven't already accomplished great things.
Oh, thank you, and it's funny, I'll be both at Wellington and also at Columbus School for Girls. I'll be doing those two back-to-back.
Oh, perfect, wow.
So if that helps to know.
Yeah.
And I'm at Columbus School for Girls one day and then Wellington the next.
Okay, yes, thank you for mentioning that. All right,
That's
well,
great.
Yeah, I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You too, take care.
Thank you,
bye.